Lolitasaurus by Richard Craven. Read by James Cameron Stewart. First, nothing. Then, something. Long, white corridors. Long strip lights flickering like strobes. You are, you ain't, a million times a moment. Our thighs, coated in plastic, rub together as we walk. In all the corridors, doors are spaced evenly along the walls. Doors and more doors, plywood and cloned grain and standard handles. If I ever opened a door, then there would be another long, white corridor with long strip lights flickering like strobes and more plywood doors. And if I were to open one of these, another corridor with strip lights and more doors. Sometimes you think you're inside the body of a whale, a clean whale, purged and bleached, with straightened curves and standardized sphincter valves. There are not many people around here, the occasional cleaner. Either they're bent cataleptically over the shaft of a mop. You walk past them, and at the end of the corridor you reach your door, and you turn around for another look, and they're still there, motionless, drooping with the fatigue of the inert. Or they're hard at work. Mop grasped in whitened knuckles, mechanized repetition of motion, scrubbing eternally the same maculation in the margin between carpet and wall, erasing the lingering trace of the last quark of dirt. I've found a nice sharp screwdriver once, or someone else did, or it found me. I walked up soundlessly behind one of the cleaners. He was in a state of absence, leaning on his mop, eyes turned inwards on the emptiness. I stuck the screwdriver into his throat and jumped back and watched the blood spurting all over the walls and the carpeting and the strip lights. He never made a sound. He just crumpled slowly to the floor, almost deliberately, as though he were making space for himself after a satisfying picnic. His leg twitched spasmodically and upset his bucket so that some dirty water got spilt on the carpet. When he'd stopped moving, I pulled down his trousers and tried to toss him off, but he wouldn't rise to the occasion. There was some bother, but I didn't get any blood on me, and I hid the screwdriver, and the CCTV was too grainy. I am in the room. The one where you eat, sleep, think, fuck, shit, and take pills. If you are going to piss or talk, you go to another room. If you are not eating, sleeping, thinking, shitting, fucking, taking pills, pissing, or talking, then you are in a corridor, my friend. You see how if you're in the room long enough, then everything you do in it merges into a single process, a mono-event in a mono-verse where time and change are meaningless. So I am in the room doing what comes to me there. They've got newspapers for you to wipe your ass on. They've got porn mags and TV and inflatable dolls with adjustable valves and straitjackets and wooden spoons and a kiosk with nurses in zip-crotched underwear who dose you up with Largactyl and fiendish antipsychotics which turn you into a dribbling lardass with no fashion sense. Thus am I when men come for me and lead me silently down the corridors. We pass the spot where I killed the cleaner, and there is not the faintest lingering scintilla of a ghost. At the end of the corridor, The door swings open into the room where you piss and talk.
"You are Mr. Moffat,"
says one of the men.
"Is correct."
"Our files indicate that you..."
Blah, blah. "Come again."
"You're cured," he says.
"No more than averagely unbalanced.
You're free. You can go."
I am standing on a gravel drive outside a large door. I look down at my hand, grasping a black valise. I seem to remember another valise whose exterior details correspond exactly to this one. The same combination lock, the same dents and scratches and tarnishments. I wonder, and not without reason, although it is no more than the idlest of speculations, whether they are one and the same valise. The contents are not the same. The one before had all kinds of useful things. Rohypnol, an oil-stained boiler suit, a couple of syringes, plastic cable ties. This one's just got clothes and money in it, and not enough of either. The sky is uniformly white. The House of Corridors stretches out behind me. Underneath my Macintosh, I have a two-piece suit. Underneath the suit, nothing. No shirt, no pants, no socks, just some torn plimsolls. In front of me is a lawn, clumps of grass and big dog skid marks strewn with deadened leaves. Beyond the lawn, a line of fir trees, bisected by an opening for the drive. I hear no sound, save the low, continuous roar of traffic. The town is approached by a slip road feeding off the bypass. I trudge along the side of the road, on a path worn by the untold migrations of others. I slip on mud and sweet wrappers and cold condoms. My only companions, two or three huge crows who flap their wings and make ungainly landings in the road and eye me quizzically as I pass. I come upon a drama in its whimpering denouement. A small collection of caravans, lines of rags hanging limply in the lifeless cold. Fetid travellers gathered in a patchouli-pungent knot around a squad car. The doors are open. The blue lights revolve. Cops, bulked out in high-vis jackets, bundle a semi-conscious youth into the back. His head cracks against the doorframe. Nobody speaks. Inside the squad car, a radio crackles.
"What's this?" says one of the policemen, catching hold of me. "You see anything?"
"You bet," I say. I stand there, smiling dumbly at the moments elapsing, before he turns from me disgustedly. "Fanny fucking fucker," he says to no one in particular. "Go on, fuck off out of it." The slip road runs past fields and past dirty little paddocks with iron troughs and forlorn ponies. After a bend, I see skyscrapers in the distance. I find myself trudging past hillsides down which spill rows of prefabricated terraces. The town is one of those high-tech affairs, laid out like the spokes of a wheel, with shopping at the still point of the turning world, and concentric circles dedicated to brave new industries and brave new housing. The roads and roundabouts are awash with late-model jelly-moulded cars, suits speeding from pointless appointment to pointless appointment. The still, sclerotic air balloons in every wake, crackling tangibly with the potencies of the doomed. The hostel, when I find it, proves at first to be surprisingly agreeable. It is one of those community centre-style bungaloids built out of glazed maroon brick. I am expected, and a single room has already been prepared for me. I even find a pormag in the bedside cabinet. I take off my suit and express my autonomy all over my crisp, new linen bedsheets. The pleasure I derive from my new surroundings soon begins to pall. The rooms are overheated, the food stodgy and institutional. I meet my fellow inmates. I am disturbed by the revelation that, to a man, they are qualitatively identical. All ex-child prodigies in their late 30s, thin hair, glasses, glazed dough-grease faces, paralyzed, motorized wheelchairs, dribble-bag smells. By far the most alarming feature, though, is the voices. Each has had his vocal cords replaced by a voice box from some Californian factory. During the endless hours of free association, they earnestly discuss with each other the state of their preparedness for independent living. The heated, somnolent dayroom air is rent with vulcanized American platitudes. They try to engage my participation. They think I am lonely. I am. I find, after this, that time is quite abruptly wrapped in an enigma. I suffer from vague presentiments of cling film and knotted nylon cords. There are flashing lights and disembodied voices rasping in a fluorescent haze. Then the sensations of jolting, cessation, fatigue, and finally stillness in a numb, white landscape. I am outside in a small clearing, snow on the ground, broken by footprints. Undergrowth merges with sickly trees. A huge, grey bust of a bearded man stares balefully at me through the thickets. I am conscious of the cold, but only as though somebody else were feeling it. If I turn my head, I can just make out the shape of a wheelchair lying athwart a rough path. I smell sewage, petrified at the precise moment of its deliquescence. When the doctor says I am well enough, the fat nurse with latex gloves removes the tubes. Then the detectives come for me and put me in their car, two in front, two either side of me in the back. We are driving through London, through some inner-outer scene of nondescription like Perivale or Edgware. "Give him the blanket then, George," says one of the detectives in the front.
"Rock on," says George,
pulling a dirty grey blanket over my head. Underneath the blanket, it smells of sweat and piddle and detective fart. I can feel the fat, warm thighs of the detectives pressing into me whenever the car rounds a corner. I hear their voices. They talk about beer and QPR and bestiality videos. The car stops. One of the detectives in front gets out. After a minute, the blanket is pulled from my head. I blink in the sudden brightness. A hand appears from nowhere and thrusts into my face a scalding kebab covered in mustard and tomato sauce. I hear myself gasp.
"What makes you do it, you twisted little cunt?" says George, slapping me across the cheek with a ringed knuckle.
My nose and upper lip throb under layers of muck and gristle. I raise a hand to wipe my face, but it is snatched away, and the blanket is thrust over my head again.
"Mad cunt," says George.
It is warm and fetid and close underneath the blanket. I can feel the mustard and the tomato sauce cooler now as it slides down my face. I taste blood. The court rises. The judge clears his throat. I don't hear much, just the standard crap about repugnant crimes and duty to the public weal. Probably does both, bouncing up and down on some rent boy. I watch him. I watch his jaw moving spasmodically, the clean-shaven face under thick eyebrows, the fright wig rented from Nanny Whiplash. It seems so far away, so shallow. Where is the man beneath all this stuff? The old life returns, with all the old precisions. The corridor runs straight and true. It is lined with doors, doors of painted steel and rivets, and little spy-holes which you can look through, or open, or shut. When you look through the holes, you can watch a little room just like your own. If there are men in it, you can watch them as they talk, or ruminate, or piss on twisted sheets and hang themselves. You can watch them as they smoke and play cards. If they are not talking, ruminating, pissing, hanging, smoking, or playing cards, they are in another room. They may be bathing and fornicating. They may be scoffing instant mash and alphabet spaghetti. I'm not joking. Life's like that. You try keeping a straight face next time you watch another Yahoo shitting on a newspaper. The real cases do it on page 3. They're all on D-Wing. You go down and down the corridor, past the green paint and the steel and the rivets, everything very pucker, deeply, deeply appropriate to the odour of the fecal tide which awaits you as you cruise through the node, the caged valve, and enter the second face of the angle. You can hear them screaming. You can go and look through spy holes at their rooms, too. You can read what they've written on the walls in their own shit.